Hello, young lovers, whoever you are, I hope your troubles are few. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I've been in love like you. You be brave, young lovers, and follow your star. Brave and faithful and true. And cling very close to each other tonight. I've been in love like you. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You fly down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet, not by chance. Don't cry, young.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark.
All my good wishes go with you tonight. I've had a love of my own. And I know how it feels to
call us toll free, 1-888-429-5471. That's 888-429-5471.
And you meet, not by chance. Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do. Say, don't cry because I'm alone. All of my memories are happy tonight.
Our guest Carol Amber gave birth to a very healthy baby boy in 2008. She and her husband were overjoyed, and little TJ was their firstborn. So when they started noticing that he wasn't quite developing just as the baby book said he should, they became a bit concerned. New parent jitters, said the pediatrician, and they reassured them. Several months later, they were walking out of a neurologist's office shocked, shell-shocked after being told that their little boy wouldn't live much longer due to a very rare and incurable genetic condition called Leigh syndrome. Carol Amber is with us. She is the most, she's proud of being TJ's mom. She is also an entrepreneur, a writer, a lover of all things food. And she and her husband have a food blog, Chop Sizzle Pop. And she's a contributing food writer for several publications. She is the author of the best-selling children's novel, The Gift of the Ladybug. And let's say, Carol, hi, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. Carol, this is a situation that I don't think any mom, any dad would ever want to face or really even go through. Obviously, no one could even describe how you felt when you were told that TJ wasn't going to make it. But where was it that the light bulb went on for you that this in and of itself, it could be a gift for not only you but others?
It was actually that night. So we went in for a second opinion to the Cleveland Clinic, and that was the night that we got the news. That's when it changed from there may be something wrong with your child to your child has a fatal disease with no cure, no treatment, and he's going to live probably 1 to 2 years. So it was this dagger, and, you know, absolutely we were devastated to the core, of course, and I really didn't know how I was going to go on. And I can remember driving home in a car in the passenger seat, and it's really rainy and really dark, and it's a December, cold December night, and I'm just beyond myself. And I'm sitting catatonic with my, basically with my mouth agape, wide open, and this flash just comes to me just very suddenly, and it's of these horses in a circle, just as my family was in a circle in the doctor's office, with TJ, my son, in the middle, and it was actually a little ladybug in the middle. And these horses were sobbing, just like I felt like sobbing, because we heard this news that the ladybug would live a short life. And the ladybug looks up to the horses and says, you know, why are you crying? I don't understand why you're crying. I don't know how to be a horse. I only know how to be a ladybug, and I'm just fine. And it was this story that actually brought me this peace in this just really harrowing moment. And then my family and I sort of embraced this story, and for the rest of TJ's life, which was maybe another 8 months or so, and we said, you know, to ourselves, every time I got really down, which was a lot, I told myself, look, if I get TJ and I get the gift of this beautiful child and this wonderful baby boy, then I can accept his condition.
Yeah, but when you really come down to it, look at the legacy TJ left. Look at the lives it could possibly touch, you know, as you move through with the people that you talk to with the book. And you were also, the book touched one girl with cancer. So the lives that will be touched, not only today, but look at 50 years, 100 years out, what this is doing. Now, nobody wanted to see, obviously, TJ go. But if he had to, look at the way he went out.
Yes, that's the truth. Yeah, and we just found out that we heard from this girl with cancer's mom, and she said, that when we gave her this book, we donated some books to some children with life-threatening illnesses, and she had literally had her 50-something cancer surgery, and she wasn't able to climb stairs for the last 4 months, and she's 9, and she's so sweet, and we met her. She read the book, and then she went on to play, because this was one of those, it was with A Kid Again, which is similar to Make-A-Wish, and it was to sort of be a kid again. And so she read the book and went to a slide and was able to climb up the stairs of the slide 3 times with help and a 4th time by herself. And when she got up to the top of the stairs, she said, "Look, Mom, I'm a ladybug, and it's my time to fly."
No,
so
absolutely.
I felt like it was PJ coming through her.
Yeah. And you know, when you really come down to it, and even if it was her at 9 years old, what about the adults? What about the 30, 40, 50, 60-year-olds that really have to experience being a ladybug? How many people go through life and never wake up? And sometimes something like this might be the trigger mechanism to cause them to wake up in their life and really start to live. Somebody once said to me, though, it was maybe 6 months ago on this show, and he was a psychic, and they had asked him, somebody asked him, what happens when you die? And his response was something I'll never forget. His response was, well, the real question should be, what happens when you begin to live?
Ha.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think that's what we're really talking about, the story in and of itself. That's something that might trigger within somebody to make them realize that they're not living. They're not living, and I say living, being aware of life around them. Yeah, they're breathing, they're doing whatever they're doing, mm-hmm. but it's still not a life, and there's always that something missing. And I really believe what you have is, quote-unquote, that trigger to the something missing, whatever that might be, and who knows if it's definable.
I think that's right. And I think in TJ's case, it was facing his fate. And I think maybe that's the case for everyone. Once you look death in the face and just realize that you're mortal, you have limited days on this planet, then it allows you to get rid of some of that fear and actually just celebrate every day.
No, absolutely. Well, you know, that's a very interesting point. When you knew he was going to die, obviously the pain and everything you went through, there's no question about it. My goodness, you're a human being. But when you got hit with that bright spot, whatever you want to call it, that spot in and of itself actually caused you a reversal. You had to come from some kind of a death to a rebirth.
Absolutely true. That I could not agree more. It was just a complete change in my way of thinking and my family as well. And it was almost like we learned that we could no longer change the outcome. Okay, this is fatal. And then we changed our entire way of thinking about it from that moment on, and we began to live with him, like absolutely live with joy and laughter, and even more so because we knew they were limited days.
Yeah. Now, by the way, did the two of you have other children?
No other children then and still now.
Okay. All right. And by the way, when it ever comes, if it does happen to you, I think that child is going to be one of the luckiest kids on this planet. When it really comes down to it, if I were to pick the book up, if I were to read it page by page, cover to cover, what would be my takeaway? What would be the one thought you would want me to walk away with once I read it? Man, woman, child, it doesn't really matter.
I would want you to know that when you love yourself exactly as you are, warts and all, short life expectancy and all, or anything that you face that makes you different, unique, special, then you can live an extraordinarily powerful life.
And by the way, the people that you talk to, the places that you speak, are they hearing the message? And I think that's extremely important. There are people who are frightened to death of hearing what you have to say. They hide themselves. They put masks on so no one can see them. They live under the conditions of other people, and it's very hard for them to step out. Something like this could be that stimulator to be able to step out. And it doesn't matter, again, how old you are. You could be 70 years old. If you've never stepped out, take that 10, 12 years, 20 years, whatever it is that you got left, and live with it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think it doesn't have to be a book about death. It can also be a book about anyone who's different in any way. But I think you're right. It's to take it to the very dramatic ending of this little boy dies and his parents have to live without him. And if they can do it, you can too.
Now, by the way, the book is not about death. The book is about life.
That's absolutely true. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. And when you really come down to it, the some of the proceeds for the book, obviously you donate. Where do you donate the proceeds?
We donate the proceeds to the United Mitochondrial Disease Foundation, and they're searching for a cure for Lee syndrome and other mitochondrial diseases and conditions.
Okay. Now, by the way, he's got to be, TJ would have had to been not just a rare, you know, few kids that get this. This is something that that a lot of kids have that we don't know about, we don't talk about, it doesn't come to the public view. Is this something that that has been running, quote-unquote, rampant and nobody's had control over? Is there just getting that awareness of the public to this problem?
I would say that's true. It's, most mitochondrial diseases are very severe, and there's no cure for any of them, and most of them are fatal. But they're also seeing that there's the mitochondria may be responsible for many other diseases, such as Alzheimer's, and I'm not even sure all of them, but that they may even have a correlation to cancer and other things. And so there's so much research that needs to be done, but I think that the mitochondria have a big impact on many different diseases.
You know, there's a word here, I keep coming back to it. The word is, you know, when you say live bold, for so many people, the word bold is, you know, you jump on your horse with the big lance and you ride off to challenge people and do whatever. That's not really bold. Bold is sometimes just getting out of bed and smiling in the morning. Bold is standing up and looking in the mirror and saying, okay, I got some problems today. Might be financial, might be relationship, might be something, but I'm going to move my way through it. So the essence of bold is not just, you know, with tremendous impact. It's living your life and standing up to what's going on and moving your way through. To somebody else, it might not even be a wink of an eye, but to you, it might be the biggest thing in the world. So bold is something that's manageable. It's something that you can do, and I think that's what the problem is. We say bold, people get this idea of, you know, the hero, the heroine going out and do whatever. That's not what bold is.
Mm-hmm. I completely agree.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So the message is live, and I think that in and of itself is critically important. Now, is there a series here of books that are going to start?
You never know. I hope so. I know there's one more at least that I want to write, and it's sort of about TJ. I asked TJ at the very end of his life, and I said, TJ, in his ear, please, can you send me something? Send me a sign that you're okay. Maybe a ladybug.
Yeah.
And literally. 3 hours later, I've come to find out that one of my uncle's little church buddies, they go to church, and in the middle of a prayer from the pastor for those who have recently passed, she got down on her knees and started drawing with crayons and drew a ladybug in flight and said to my uncle, I think you need this. And he gave it to us that day, and I thought, this is our sign. I mean, and then there's been live ladybugs surrounding our windows for 2 months after he died, and I think there might be a really neat sequel with the spiritual ladybug coming back.
Yeah, the return of ladybug. I love it.
Yeah, the return of the ladybug, and that perhaps consciousness never dies.
Oh, I hear you. Carol Amber, we're just about done for time. Let me ask you this. Is there a website we can find you at?
Absolutely. It's called giftoftheladybug.com, and the book's available there and on Amazon.
Wonderful. Hey, Carol, thank you so much for being here. What a heck of a message.
Thank you so much. It was my pleasure.
Take care. Good night.
Good night.
There's so many exciting and wonderful places, mountains and jungles and desert oases, pleasant as home is, it isn't what Rome is, so why stay there? When there are so many fabulous faraway places to see. Why should Spain and Tahiti and Rio just be only names to you and me? I feel certain there's people we'd be glad to know there. So tell me, why don't we get up and just go there? Go to those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London, wonderful, fabulous places we're longing to see. Oh,
so many simply incredible places to see. When I think of the warm Caribbean, I see a new world for you and me. I'd give anything just to have one single day there. And once we get there, I know that we'll stay there. Stay in those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London, Siam, Siena, Vienna, Verona, Java, Jamaica, Bombay, Barcelona. Show me those fabulous places we're longing to see.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to thought-provoking talk on Dresser After Dark. Dr. Jan Schwartz with us. She's the author of Last Summer with Oscar, an adventurous true story of love and of courage. Jan received her B.S. in education from Valparaiso University, her master's and doctoral degrees from the University of Pittsburgh. She taught K-1 through 7 and 8, coordinated a gifted program for middle school youngsters, and also worked as a child counselor at a domestic violence shelter. Prior to receiving her graduate training to become a family therapist, she now performs white-collar organized crime investigations and various projects that work to help strengthen our government. Jan, hi, welcome to the show.
Hi, Michael. It's great to be with you and your listeners this evening.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. You know, well, last summer with Oscar, you know, obviously we're talking about a dog here. We're talking about a 9-year-old dog. And there are so many people don't realize dogs are so susceptible to cancer, and I was surprised when I found out how many dogs get it. When did you realize that that Oscar was sick?
Well, we returned home from a vacation and discovered that he wasn't able to eat, and I began doing these food games to try to entice him to eat, but after a couple of days of that, it was time to take him to the vet. And so our vet declared to us, we're so sorry, as he pointed out, the x-rays, the tumors were everywhere. He had such an enormous amount of cancer in him, and sadly, it was too widespread for surgery, and chemotherapy didn't seem right for our gentle-natured golden retriever. But we were caught off guard, and so, you see, I have two questions for you and your listeners. The first being, what would you do if your dog developed cancer? And the second...
Okay.
And the second, if your dog led you to an alternative cancer treatment, would you know to listen to him? We were in a position that we needed to come up with answers to those questions. And as you can imagine, it's devastating to learn that your pet has cancer, and you react just as if you experienced it, you know, with a human family member. There's these great feelings of anticipatory loss, feelings of helplessness and grief. And our vet had told us that Oscar would die from being unable to eat. So from the moment we heard that, we knew we weren't doing chemotherapy. We knew we weren't going to be able to do surgery. And so my husband and I looked at each other and said, we committed to each other that we were going to find something for Oscar to eat no matter what. And there were many moments that we needed to really stretch our imaginations. But then something happened. And what I encourage you and your listeners to think about is the first thing we need to do is be attentive, because your dog or pet may lead you to what he or she needs. And this is what happened to us.
I'm going to say, how did that happen? Obviously, if you're going to go natural, if you're going to go that way with them,
yes,
that's not something that they're going to walk around the house and find.
No, not at all. In fact, we had this habit of walking 3 miles every other evening, and it would be Oscar and Winston, and Winston's Oscar's litter mate. And we would walk along this circular route on this road, but on this evening, Oscar pulled me into the bushes, and rather than having him walk, you know, beside me and be orderly and all these, you know, dog training, you know, things that we do to try to keep our dog behaving well, I didn't care. I wanted him to have fun, and I'm glad I did that, because when he came out from the bushes, he was eating these leaves, and he was sucking them off of these branches as if he were an anteater, and they were sticking all over his face. And I was fascinated because, first of all, he was eating, and then secondly, what would make him want to eat these leaves? And his tail was wagging. And then this became a pattern. Two nights later, again, two nights later after that, and it was time to get serious, and it was time to find out what these leaves were. And I needed to call in an expert, and I also needed to do some research, because what Oscar chose as his treatment, slippery elm seedling.
Mm. No, I did. Such,
yes, yep. You know, and then I just get so excited about this because I just want everyone to know about it. There is a very rich Native American Indian history on the usefulness of slippery elm for cancer, for many, many other purposes. And in fact, in our own American history, it's played a vital role because the Native American Indians taught George Washington and the troops how to survive in the American Revolution on slippery elm gruel. And they would peel the bark, and there is this white strip there, and they would chop that white strip and boil it and create like an oatmeal, you know, a gruel. And this is how they lived in those wintry months where the supplies couldn't get to them. And today, the drug companies use slippery elm. It's a component in many drug formulas. And so, sadly, the tree is now on the endangered species list. Mm-hmm. So you might be wondering, well, Jan, that can only take you so far, and you're absolutely right. But this was a miraculous journey, and suddenly, you know, a catalog appeared in the mail, and it was a catalog from the only natural pet store that happens to be in Boulder, Colorado. And this, in this booklet, there were evidence-based remedies for use for pets for cancer. And so we began to try some of those along with the slippery elm. And this was a seasonal journey. We know that the leaves were going to fall off the trees, and I was greatly concerned about what Oscar would be like because his mood was so greatly changed when he had a chance to eat the leaves from the slippery elm trees. And when they did fall off the trees, and Oscar was frantic and looked at me with those eyes that we all know from our dogs or cats or whomever, whatever pets, and they look at us like, all right, Mama, what are you going to do now to help me? And the pressure was on, and once again, I really needed to do good research, and I had to do it very rapidly because we did not want Oscar to break the pattern of continuing to live with his cancer. And guess what I found this time?
Aha, what?
Graviola tree extract. And it was in the form of a tablet called Gravazon from the Amazon and the Amazon Herbs Company. This was an amazing remedy, and it also has a rich history of helpfulness in curing cancer with indigent tribes in the Amazon. So imagine what it felt like from my perspective, as I felt that I was being taught and being led by this animal, by this precious, beloved Oscar. And I was his student. He was the teacher.
Now, by the way, you said something very interesting. You were the student. He was the teacher. One of the things that you do talk about is Oscar's inner strength is that, excuse me, that profound will and the determination to press on despite the limitations. Now, let's say that in a different way. What I love about animals, and I've got bunches of animals I always have, is that They can be disabled. They can be something. They take what they have, and they still give everything they got as if life is, that's the way it is, and they move on with life. It would be very interesting if we as human beings could do the same thing.
Yes. They teach us how to live.
Absolutely.
They, They inspire us.
Yeah, I've got three big dogs here, four cats, and it's, well, I don't have them. They have me. It's a learning lesson constantly. And if more people would learn from these animals, and it's true, one of them's got arthritis, but does that stop him? Absolutely not. He's curtailed in, you know, the way he plays and the way he moves, but he still moves and he still plays to the best that he can, and he doesn't know any difference.
Yes. Yes, I completely understand. And, you know, animals bring out the best in us. And with Oscar's journey, what I also found fascinating was that his determination and his strength as he continued to walk, even though he appeared to be as if he were living through a famine. I mean, this dog would walk these 3 miles, and the police would come by, and they'd cheer him on, and children would be cheering, and people were saying, "How are you doing today, Oscar?" What is he up to now? Because his weight would be fluctuating, and it was so gratifying, and it brought out the best in others, and that's what goodness does. But dogs offer us, and pets offer us, such a pure quality of love that we want to just give our best back to them, and especially when they need us so desperately to help them. But one thing I want to be sure to convey to you is that there was a wonderful moment where this woman said, when she heard that, she said, "Well, what's Oscar struggling with now? What's he now trying to overcome on this journey?" And I said, "He has a tumor that is under his tongue, and that is interfering with his ability to eat." And she said, "Gee, have you considered trying red clover?" Well, by then I already knew that this was going to be our next remedy. And indeed, after just a couple of days of trying it, under Oscar's tongue, we could see the color fading and that the tumor was breaking up. And within 4 or 5 days, Oscar was able to eat again, not requiring surgery, just naturally healing. And I was strengthened by feeling the support from others who wanted to help an animal who was trying so hard to teach me something, which, of course, now I want to teach everybody else. I want to share all that I learned from Oscar. But cancer is a multifaceted disease, and we really, really wanted to keep him eating, and that meant we had to come up with an effective collection, a combination of remedies. And I'm so happy to share with you, Michael, that eventually there was this sense that, okay, we could tell. Now we got the whole picture covered, and you know how we could tell? Because Oscar's appetite grew ravishingly. This dog went from not wanting to eat at all to an appetite that I couldn't keep up with. I mean, I was cooking all over the place, and in the book I share this recipe, Oscar's favorite orange chicken recipe, which, you know, I made lots of chickens, which we do, we want to do. But we achieved the goal of helping him eat. And I am happy to tell you that, and I'm filled with joy to tell you that, what had been a devastating moment when we learned about the cancer, turned into an experience that truly became one of the most loving experiences of my lifetime and my husband's lifetime. And people learned from this animal. And also, with great joy, I share with you that when tests were done on Oscar's body, they did not find any evidence of cancer. And so we believe, of course we're going to believe, sure, we're going to say with strong hope that the treatment, the remedies were working.
Jen, let me ask you this. We're starting to run out of time, but I do have a question for you. With authors, you know, fact, fun, fantasy, fiction, whatever the case may be, mm-hmm, when you decide to put a subject to pen, there is that moment of, there's that cathartic moment, that aha moment that happens. And there's something, a dimension of the subject matter that you weren't aware of before you went in. Where was that for you? Where did you get that click, that spark?
You know, what really stirred my heart as I was writing this, and this was a very painful writing for me. I wrote it in a copy shop, and I needed to feel people support around me for quite a while, and my Facebook friends, and there was great support from other authors. But what I felt encouraged by, and what was pushing me on to do this, the number of people who came over to me and asked about what Oscar and Winston's life was like before he had cancer. And it was just feeling the enormous wish of others. And I would never have written this book had people not said, and especially a woman by the name of Ginny Greenhill, who said to me, you know, I hope you're writing this down. And I hadn't thought of even writing any of this down. I just assumed this was just put on my plate to deal with, and I was going to love Oscar to the hilt. And so in this book, I wanted to make certain that everyone who contributed to this story, I wanted to hold them up. I wanted to raise them up, and I wanted to say to the world, this is just one example of how we can tackle our life's problems, that if we need a connectedness with each other, and that solutions are out there for our problems if we only choose to look for them and remain connected. And so as I wrote the book, I was filled with a compassion and filled with a determination and a conviction that I grew filled with a strengthened belief in the potential of humanity as the story took shape and as I developed a writer's cadence, as we would say, a pattern, you know, to my writing. It was filled with gratitude to all who made the story possible.
And we're just about out of time now. Website we can find you.
Yes, at lastsummerwithoscar.com. And I'm happy to share with you that the feedback has been so heartwarming. In fact, I even had two people email me saying that they have read the story to their dogs.
Wow.
But the book, yeah, I know. Isn't that precious?
That's great.
I would
that's
never.
Absolutely great.
Now, that's pure. That's really not just precious, but that is just pure creativity.
Absolutely. Jan, we got to go on. I want to thank you so much for joining us tonight.
I'm so grateful, Michael. Thank you so much.
Take care. Good night.
Bye. Good night.
Said some of these days I do it so good, you're gonna miss me, honey. And I'm talking about days when you feel all blue. You're gonna miss my hugging, you're gonna miss my kissing, you may even miss me, baby, when I'm long gone away. I hope you feel lonely and want me only, 'cause you know, lover, you always had your way. And if you whatever you've done, it's all over. Whatever you've been is so strange.
Yes. Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to thought-provoking talk on Dresser After Dark. Call us toll-free, 888-429-5471. Steve Borey with us. He's the author of The American Casino Guide, the most comprehensive publication available. For information on any U.S. casino, resort, riverboat, or Indian casino, his guide has been published annually since 1992 and is the number one best-selling book in the U.S. on the subject of casino, gambling, and travel. Steve, hi, welcome to the show.
Hi, Michael. How are you?
Oh, I'm good. Thank you so much for being here. More than 54 million travelers visit U.S. casinos every year. Steve, what I found out years and years ago, there are people who get addicted to things, drugs, alcohol, et cetera. But the number one addiction in the world is gambling.
Maybe. I don't know. I would tend to think alcohol might be ahead of it. I'm not sure about that one.
No, if you check it, I think you'll find gambling is the big one. For whatever reason, think about that. The average person, without your experience, you sit down at the machines, right? And you put some money in, and you think, I'll just do it one more time. And then I'm going to do it one more time. And before you know it, you've done it so many times, you don't have any money left. I think that it's addictive. It's not a bad thing. It's just what it is.
Well, it's, like anything else, you got to be careful, whether it's drugs or alcohol or gambling. Sure. People do, unfortunately, get addicted to it.
No, absolutely. Now, by the way, 35 years of experience with this, what was it about gambling that sparked you? What caused you to get that something that said, this is what I'm going to concentrate on, and this is what I'm going to write about and be part of?
Well, I was always curious about gambling. I always enjoyed it, and I had worked in the parimutuel industry, which is different than casino gambling, because casino gambling, it's you against the house, and parimutuels, it's you against the other bettors, and the house takes a commission out. So I was always intrigued by casino gambling, and I would go to casinos. I mean, it started out by, like most people, they go out, and they're not familiar with it, and they have an interest in it, and they learn more about it. So the book developed through the years. When it started out, there wasn't that much casino gambling in the United States. They had just opened the first riverboat casinos. And since then, it's continued to spread throughout the United States.
Now, by the way, I want to talk about card counting for a moment. You could, with all of your experience as a card counter, you could sit down at a blackjack table and you can pretty much tell what's going to come up, can't you?
Well, if you're a card counter, you know the relationship of high cards to low cards. And when there's more high cards, you bet more money. And when there's more low cards, you bet as little money as possible. Because when there's more high cards, it favors you as the player because you'll get more blackjacks. And if you get more blackjacks, you get paid 3-2. Yeah. And the dealer will also bust more often because the dealer has to play by set rules. He has to draw on hands of 16 or more, so... What you can do as a player, you can stand on the lower hands. You don't have to hit them if you know there's more tens. And the dealer has to hit those, and he'll bust more often. So that's how you get an edge as a card counter. But they don't know exactly what's coming out. They just know, the relationship of high cards to low cards.
Okay, well, card counters are pretty good. This is not somebody you want to be up against in a card game.
Well, if you count cards, I counted cards myself. I counted for about 8 years. But I just did it to see if I could do it because I always heard it worked and it did work. But I never bet a lot of money. I was not trying to go out there to make a living at it. I was just curious as to whether or not it worked. So I took the time and effort. It took me several months to learn how to do it. And I, one of the problems is if you go to the same casino all the time and you bet a lot of money, it's very easy to tell your counting cards. And all they're going to do is kick you out of the casino. So at that time, we had a casino boat here, and my friend and I would go once a week, once every 2 weeks to the same boat and see the same people all the time. So you can't go there and bet lots of money when the count is high because they're going to catch on, and they track you, and they know if you're winning or losing money. They always track you at the table. So people may think, if you're a card counter, you can go in and you can treat the casino like your own ATM. Well, to a point you can, but they're going to wise up and just throw you out. They're going to say, we don't want your business here. You can't play here anymore.
Yeah, see, most people would love to play and gamble, but I want to read the rest of the headline because I think this in and of itself is critical. More than 54 million travelers visit the U.S. casino every year. Unfortunately, most of them pay way too much for their vacation, and 99% of them are clueless when it comes to gambling. That's what the book is about, isn't it? So you can kind of hold somebody by the hand and say, this is the best place to go, and this is what to do.
Well, it gives them tips, for how to play the game. The book itself, the front part has stories on how to play the games. The middle part has information on the casinos, and the back part has coupons to save you money when you go to the casinos. But again, like it says, most people, when they go, they're going to go right to a slot machine, and slot machine really isn't the best thing to play in a casino. People don't understand it, but you can sort of comparison shop, different games in a casino. Each game has a cost to play it, and some games the cost is less than others.
When we really look at it, and most people don't know, you know, clueless again, it is, and I'm going to take it back to where I was going with that. Most people need to get their hands held when they're into something completely different. Think about it. If I've got a manual and if I know I want to go to a gambling casino, I want to travel in certain places, and if I can get to a point where I can save money by going to the right place, by pretty much getting a handle on what I'm going to do if I'm going to do some gambling, I think that in and of itself has got to be a gift to most people. Most people don't know, and they spend way too much money that they didn't have to spend, and they don't get the enjoyment that they normally could get. That's why I'm liking what you're doing here.
Well, I try and encourage people to set a budget. You know, you got to set a budget. Don't use your rent money. Don't use your food money. Just have money that you can afford to lose. If you're to go out and have a nice evening, go into a show and a dinner, you know, set aside a budget like that and enjoy your night at the casino. If you lose the money, it was your entertainment budget. But, you know, even though I can write these stories and give people, you know, I can tell you the best way to play your hand in any given situation in a blackjack game, but one thing that happens is, you know, luck comes into play. And I can tell you how to play the game exactly perfectly. I can tell you which tables have the best rules to play. But you may go there and you may, you know, lose $500 in an hour and say, well, that Steve, he was a jerk. Well, you may have had a bad losing session. But over time, you know, these are things that work over time. So you may have bad sessions, but you'll have more good sessions. So, you know, because the average blackjack game is you play with perfect basic strategy. It has a casino advantage of about 0.5%. But you may have a bad day there and you know, lose several hundred dollars. But over the long run, if you play with perfect basic strategy, most blackjack games, you would lose at a rate of about 0.5% of the total amount you bet.
You know, there's something that I've seen that I've always thought was a little bit scary. They've got casinos on websites. Are those safe to play with?
Well, you never know what's happening on a website. You always want to play in a regulated jurisdiction. Nowadays, some of the European casinos are regulated internet casinos, but you'd have to do some research on it. I mean, if you go in a casino in Atlantic City or a riverboat casino, Indiana, Iowa, Illinois, you know there's a gaming commission that regulates the chips and the machines to make sure that they're paying back what they're supposed to be, that the games are played on an honest basis. But with an internet casino, you may never really know what's going on.
Yeah, I can imagine that. And when you really come down to it, there are so many people who they're so used to the internet, and if it's a casino and if they're going to gamble, I would venture to guess that most people don't expect to win anything anyway. And I know what that sounds like, but I would venture that there's probably fewer winners than there are losers out there. That's why the casinos are so popular. Now, how do you tell, and this is one of the things you talk about, which I think is a good thing, how do you tell when you're a problem gambler?
Well, we have a story in the book. The book's put in there each year, so you can take this test. I think there's, and I haven't addressed it. I see it each year when I write when I put the book together here. It's a story called "A Few Last Words." So, according to Gamblers Anonymous, you may be a problem gambler if you answer yes to at least 7 of the following 20 questions. So, there's a little quiz in there. Gamblers Anonymous has this 20 question quiz. And you know, you can go in there and be honest and answer some of these questions, like, do you ever gamble to escape worry or travel? Do you ever gamble longer than you plan? So questions like that. And if you answer yes to some of them, you say, well, you know, maybe I should look into this. And we have numbers in there too for people to go to for help if they think they may have a problem.
Yeah. Okay. And by the way, I think that makes a lot of sense. Who would even think about that if you had no idea even beforehand? Now, the book in and of itself, do you find it changing year after year? Do you find, based on a different culture that we live in, based on different ideologies and the way people think, do you find that the book changes a little bit? Or when it comes to gambling, gambling is gambling, and that's that constant that stays straight through no matter what year you're in or what kind of an environment you're in?
Well, the table games never really change very much. It's the slot machines. They keep coming out with these slot machines with these bonus rounds, and they're becoming more like a video arcade game, some of them. So that changes. The other thing that changes is the growth of casino gambling. It's still a growing industry. Atlantic City is right now is in big trouble because Pennsylvania legalized casinos a couple of years ago, and it's really hurting their bottom line. Also now New York, they have racinos. Racinos are slot machines at racetracks. They don't have the table games, but they have these racinos at the Parimutuels in New York State, so that's hurting them also. And then this year, or was late last year, Massachusetts legalized casino gambling. So they are in the process of putting in these casinos. And also Ohio has casinos now, which are going to open, I think the four of them are going to open within the next 4 months.
You know, what an interesting thought when you come down to it. The economy that we're in right now is a little bit scary. They're yelling about people aren't working. People don't have enough money. The gas prices are going up. Food prices increased about 9%. And yet people always seem to have enough money to gamble. And so when you really come down to it, that we still have money here. And it shows in the gambling, the entertainment field, and the rest of it. When everybody is saying it's scary, we're short, no, we're not, because if somebody's got something that they want to buy, they'll find the money to do so.
Mm-hmm. I think you're right about that. And if you go to Las Vegas, there's gamblers, casinos for every type of gambler. You have the high rollers on the Las Vegas Strip, and downtown you have the low rollers with $5 blackjack.
Oh, absolutely, and no question about it. The one thing, I haven't been to Vegas in years and years, but the one thing I always loved about Vegas was when you left at the airport, watching the young couples and the wives screaming at the husbands about what they spent and what they lost and now what they're not going to have when they go home. Constant story. Now, when we come down to it and we come down to gambling in and of itself, are there any of the state, are there any of the state-backed gambling, or are they doing anything like that to overcome some of the budget crunches the state has, or all these are all private individuals who own the gambling licenses?
Well, each state is a little different. In some states, there are video gaming machines which are run in conjunction with the state lotteries. And in one state, Kansas has their own casino that's run by the state itself. I mean, most casinos are independent, and they pay a tax. You know, there's a gaming commission, and they calculate how much was taken in, and the casinos pay a tax based on that. But another state, I think in Maryland it is, it's a little weird in Maryland because the corporations have the casinos. It's only, just table games there. But the state owns the slot machines that are put in the casino. I think that's the only state that has that. So every state's a little bit different.
No, that's kind of interesting because as much as people love to gamble, I don't mean like to gamble, love to gamble, which is a great thing. I mean, if that's what's entertainment for you, go ahead and do it to your fullest. That's how I feel about it. But at the same time, you'd think more and more states would actually get involved in owning some of these casinos because of the lack of income. And it's a great way to generate income, and it's not hurting anybody.
Well, if I were in the state, I would say, let the independent corporations run it, and we'll just tax it. That way we don't have any headaches. We don't have to put up any money. Because for a while there, you couldn't open a casino, at least in Las Vegas, unless you're spending $2 billion. Those days are gone. They can't borrow the money anymore. And, if they could borrow it, they'd have to have so much business to pay off the debt that probably wouldn't be profitable. So they say that those days are gone. There aren't going to be any big major openings in Las Vegas for many, many years to come.
That's what we want, a gambling bailout. That's the next shot. We're just about out of time. Do you have a website we can find you at?
We do, AmericanCasinoGuide.com. And you can go there, and we put a lot of the information in the book. We put it on the website, and the book, people like the book a lot because we have coupons in there. Usually, if you use one or two of the coupons, you can recover the cost of the book.
Wonderful. Hey, thank you so much for joining us. I've appreciated your time. And realistically, casinos will always be here, and you might as well get a leg up on it. Get a hold of the book if you're going to go do it ahead of time. Save a couple of bucks on your hotel room and go play.
Thank you very much, Michael.
Okay, take care. Good night.
You too. Bye-bye. And a loving, burning light will warm up in the night. That's all. That's all. Yeah.
There are those, I am sure, that told you they would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore, for now and evermore. That's all. That's all. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore. Yeah, it's me that you adore. For now and evermore. That's all.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought-Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark, the instant survivor, right ways to respond when things go wrong. Our guest, Jim Moorhead, is the author of A Four-Step System for Conquering Professional and Personal Crises. Americans are suffering, listen to this, a downdraft of problems, downsizing, divorce, disability, debt, among so many other things. U.S. businesses are estimated to lose about $75 billion a year due to employee, listen to these words, hidden grief over personal issues like reduced productivity, increased error, and accidents, and the list goes on. Our guest author, Jim Moorhead, is a crisis advisor to national political candidates, Fortune 500 companies, and major companies, and their executives. Poses four simple questions to help any individual prevent and tackle life's hard and soft crises in an organization. And we're going to get into those questions. Hey, Jim, welcome back. It's been a long time.
It has been, Michael. It's great to be back.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. Crisis, and especially today, Jim, we are surrounded by it. You listen to the media, that's all you hear is one crisis after another, after another, after another. Now, I know this is what you deal with, you work with every day, internationally on a daily basis. But there are so many times when somebody runs into a problem, even if it's major corporations, even if it's political, ideological. The problem is they don't know how to deal with it. They don't know how to take the first step to get to where they need to be to get some kind of resolution. So the problem starts. What's one of the first questions we ask?
Well, I think to talk about the problem for a moment, you're exactly right. Because people don't know what to do, they're afraid. And when they're afraid, they freeze up and they stand still in the face of disaster. And so that's something that you never want to do. You never want to stand still when trouble is staring you in the face. You want to get going. You want to move on the problem. And the way to do it is to have a system, four steps, that you can follow to move through it. And that's why I wrote this book.
I think an extremely important also, you know, is your background. You know, obviously you're an attorney, you're a crisis advisor, Harvard College, Columbia Law School graduate, etc. Now, but when you come down to it, if there is a crisis, one of the major problems I think most firms face today is if you make the wrong step, it's going to cost you billions of dollars because somebody's going to get their attorney and say you did it wrong. So there are rules of the road, and I think that to stay up on an even playing field, you've got to be able to lean on somebody who's been there, who's done that, and knows what not to do as opposed to what to do.
I think that's right. There are a number of companies get into trouble, and a lot of it's, and individuals as well, because we don't plan and we don't prepare for trouble, even though we know it's coming into our lives. It's not a question of whether, it's just when. And so my rule is that you want to be prepared by having your own crisis management plan and your own crisis management team in place, ready to go. And that's what will really help you stay frosty, as I call it as step one, stay super cool because you won't be winging it. You won't be feeling frustrated and like a failure because you don't know what to do. Instead, you can follow the written crisis management plan and get going and unfreeze your brain and start towards a solution.
So in essence, you want something where you're going to anticipate it, even if it doesn't happen. So you're there in prevention as opposed to getting hit once something happens. The team is ready. The team knows exactly what to do just in case. Is that what we're saying?
You know, we are. And just to give you kind of a quick example of that, let me just talk for a moment about Max. Max is in his 50s. He's a Vietnam vet. And when he was in Vietnam, a hand grenade blew up right near him, took off his legs, one of his arms, Ouch. And he ended up at Walter Reed Hospital and struggling and started drinking. And what pulled him out of that was having the support of Alcoholics Anonymous and other disabled vets. And he worked through his alcoholism, but then later on he lost his job. And at that point, he had learned the power of having the support of other people, so he knew what to do. And he found another support group of people who had lost their jobs and flamed out in their careers, and they helped build him back up. Sometimes he helped them, sometimes they helped him, but he got another job, and he demonstrated really step two of the instant survivor system, which is secure support. If you're in trouble, do what the cops do on the TV shows. Call for backup.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I mean, there's no question about that. There's so many people, you know, we're taught to, you know, man up. You know, you suck it up and go ahead and handle what's going on. That doesn't work today. There are so many variables to come into play that, Jim, when you really take a look at it, you've got to be have a support system. That system that is, quote unquote, been there, done that, they know exactly what to do, and that it can relate to whatever the problem is. And I really believe having a support system in a business, having a crisis-oriented support system before anything even happens is really the place to go. And I wonder how many businesses even think about that. You know, they're out there being productive. They're out there trying to increase the bottom line. And they don't think about what's going to happen if XYZ comes up.
Well, and that's right. And you mentioned about how much money they lose each year because their employees are really hurting on the job. You know, one of the goals of any great CEO is to make the whole team better. And by training their employees in how to use this four-step system, they will turn pain into profit. And the other thing they'll do is to regain some of the trust of their employees, because a recent poll showed that only 12% of employees believe their company actually cares about them. So by reaching out to employees, particularly when they're really hurting, is a way for a company to say, we care about you.
Now, by the way, I think that's one of the things today that will keep people a step ahead of the game, because, well, you know, all of these businesses out there, they're, you know, they want to be competitive with the next guy. They want to do this. They want to increase the bottom line, and they're going out looking for new customers. One of the main things that we can do today, if anybody's got any kind of a mind, is you work with the people that you have. You build the customers you have, but more important than that, and you just said it, you build your employees. You get a team working inside, and they've got to feel like they've got a vested interest in the company. Not necessarily a profit percentage, but an interest in the company, meaning that the company doesn't survive if it wasn't for them. And I think that's extremely important today, especially in today's market.
And particularly because as you said, you don't need to have a financial stake in the company, but you do need to feel you've got kind of a family stake in the company, that the company is looking out for you, that it's watching out for you, that it knows when you're sick, that it knows to look out for you. So it's such an important part of a great company's culture.
Yeah, and by the way, the name of the book, The Instant Survivor, I think the word survivor is key. And in today's world, especially, I can't say this enough, you've got to be able to survive. And you don't just survive. There are tools, there are methods, there are techniques to get you where you want to go. And if you know what you're doing, if you know what you're doing ahead of time and you move through, you can survive and you can make it through this economic downturn.
You know, one of the things that's kind of counterintuitive as well is that to actually get through a crisis, you have to be selfish. And let me just give you a quick example of that. Robin, who works in TV, 38 years old, got breast cancer. And so she turned into just being Robin to Robin with breast cancer. And her friends were great, but they also almost suffocated her with suggestions about what she should do and what she should say and what she should eat and what she should drink. And finally she decided, Robin did, you have to live life for yourself. So she made a series of decisions to show that she ran her life, not her cancer and not her well-meaning friends. So she decided almost right away to tell her viewers that she had breast cancer. She went back to work long before people thought she should while she was still getting treatments. She shaved off her hair before her hair fell out. And then she had a trusty little wig she used, and she ditched that long before her hair had grown back. So sometimes, really, to get through a crisis, you have to be selfish. She was. That's what allowed her to get through it. And that's what the instant survivor system sets you up to do, is to move through a crisis quickly, because you want it to be a short story, not a long saga.
No, absolutely. And I really believe when you come down to something like that, I don't even know if I would call it selfish. What I would call it is the, I'm going to use the word survive again, the ability to survive, the ability to move through something, because whatever her family life was, whatever her job position was, et cetera, without her, certain things wouldn't work. And if you can't take care of yourself first, then everything around you falls apart, i.e. the old example of the oxygen on the plane, and you give it to yourself for the baby. You give it to yourself. Baby can't take care of you. If you take care of yourself, then you handle what's around you. I think that's the same thing with the business and surviving and responding.
And it's actually what I tell my companies that I work with in the crisis situations is, think of survival. That's the best thing to think of. That's what actually your employees and your customers and your suppliers and the community around you need. They need you to survive. And if you're thinking in that mindset, then that's what can help pull you through it. The best crisis survivors, they know who they are, they know what they need to do, and they do it.
Yeah, and by the way, the four steps that you're talking about, this can be for a major multi-billion-dollar corporation, or how about a family? How about a mom and dad and kids? The process is still the same. Surviving is surviving is surviving.
And by the way, picking up on that point, a crisis is a crisis is a crisis.
Yeah.
You don't need to think, oh gosh, this situation is different. The same four steps apply, of staying cool, of securing support, of standing tall, meaning that you take control of the crisis rather than being controlled by it. And you work off paper, and you put together action plans, and you put together goals and to-do lists. And then the fourth step, really, of saving your future. You don't want to have a series of disasters on your hand. And the way to avoid that, and I describe this in The Instant Survivor, is to do a one-hour life audit on yourself so that you really take a close look at the four big areas of your life, your health and your finances and your career and your relationships, and see where you're strong, where you're doing well, but where you're weak, and what you need to shore up and correct so that you'll be in a stronger position going forward and not as vulnerable to a crisis.
Jim, is there an example you can use with that? Is there somebody that you know used that process that turned them around?
Well, I can give you an example of a company. That's probably the best one that used the process and actually was kind of resistant to it. But it's a Fortune 500 company, can't give you the name, but they did a vulnerability audit. And within a couple of years after they did it, they faced an embezzlement. There was a tornado. They had a labor strike. Just a series of crises rained down on them. And they said afterwards that they were much better equipped to handle these crises because they had looked at themselves first and seen where they were weak, how they should build up their crisis response, and be ready for the trouble that ended up coming very quickly.
Yeah, and by the way, very interesting, when the companies have a foundation of how they make their decisions, you know, where those decisions come from. And most importantly, most companies need somebody to come in, look at it, look over their shoulder effectively, and see things that they don't see, bring that invisible stuff up to the table. That's why guys like yourself, you walk in, You're looking at it from an overall perspective. If somebody's right in the middle of it, there are things, Jim, that they just miss, they don't see. That's why I think the book is critical. And if you consult, you know, one-to-one with the business, we think we know everything. We don't. And that's where the problem starts. It's not what we don't know. It's what we don't know that gets us into trouble.
Well, and you're so right, whether it's a company or whether it's a family, it can be its own little small contained unit and echo chamber where its view of the world is just so narrow and so, you know, cramped. And it oftentimes does take someone from the outside to shine some light in, to take the roof off and say, okay, here's what's really going on here. Here are the dynamics of these troubles, and here's some steps you can take to put things back on the right track.
You know, I'll bet any amount of money. You know, you've been on CNN, CNBC, MSNBC, Fox News, Business News, Court TV. You've been on a lot of them. And I would venture to guess that through your eyes now, away from the camera, you could probably walk through their businesses and find six or seven things that they hadn't even thought of or looked at that we've talked about tonight. See, this is not something that that's limited in scope. This is something that happens to every business out there. And I would bet any amount of money, and I'm positive I wouldn't be wrong, if you and I could go do a survey of 1,000 businesses across country in every different location, etc., we would find that 90-some-odd percent of those businesses didn't even think about doing what you're talking about.
Well, and that's right. And you wonder why that's the case, because the studies show that $1 spent in prevention can save $7 in the cleanup costs. It makes sense for companies to do this. I think they resist doing it because they think, well, we don't want to spend the money on it. We don't want to spend the time on it. I won't get credit for it internally by doing that. And we'll just take care of whatever happens when it happens.
Now, by the way, I think that I won't get credit internally by doing that is probably the major point. We have a tremendous amount of egos out there. Good, bad, or indifferent, that's the way it is. Take somebody with a business that they're starting out with, and if it's their business and if it's their idea and they've got an ego that's motivating them, they bring people in who know less than they do so they can be in charge. This hurts them down the road. Anybody in business that's smart brings people in who know more than they do.
Well, and also who are brave enough to step up. I mean, how many times in your business have you hit a sticking point? You know, there's something that needed to be said about a certain department or a certain section, but you didn't say it or felt you couldn't say it because you were worried about opening up and upsetting the people that you work with. You know, there's a woman who had that problem on a personal level, Terry. She was a very successful professional, but lived for 30 years with a secret. So she never felt normal. And her secret held her back from really committing to another person. And the reason she never felt she could have a normal life is because her uncle had sexually abused her as a teenager, and she buried it and never told anyone. And she finally told her story to a prosecutor when she heard that her uncle was accused of molesting somebody else. So sometimes the toughest crises are the ones that others can't see and we won't let them see and won't speak up about. And sure, Terry's now free because she did speak up. But too many companies, as you said, bury trouble. And people don't have the strength and don't get the credit for speaking up about what's really a problem in a company.
Yeah, and if you're an employee, you have to be acknowledged, and if that acknowledgement, if I can say the word, is about 200% of the your ability to perform and function. Jim, we're just about out of time. Please, website, we can find you and get the book, or books, actually.
Sure. The book is The Instant Survivor. My website is instantsurvivor.com, and it has links there to Amazon and to Barnes & Noble. You can find it in bookstores and in airports. But I also just want to mention quickly, on the website, instantsurvivor.com, you can download a free Instant Survivor handbook, which will give you your own crisis management plan and your own crisis management team template. And
okay,
just do those two things, that will put you far down the field towards being in better shape for the future.
Okay, do I have to sign up for it? How do I get it?
You get it just as a download when you go to my site, instantsurvivor.com.
as simple as giving you my email.
That's right.
Love every second of it. Hey, Jim, thank you so much for being here. I appreciate it every time you're on. And don't be a stranger. We'll see you again.
Excellent, Michael. Really enjoyed it. Great questions. Thank you.
Take care. Good night.
Good night.
Hello, young lovers, whoever you are, I hope your troubles are few. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I've been in love like you. You be brave, young lovers, and follow your star. Brave and faithful and true. And cling very close to each other tonight. I've been in love like you. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You fly down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet, not by chance. Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do. Say don't cry because I'm alone. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I have had a love of my own. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You wing down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet, not by chance. Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do. Say don't cry because I'm alone. All of my memories are happy tonight. I have had a love of my own. Hallelujah! I've had a love of my own like yours. I have had a love of my own. Hello, young lovers, whoever you are, I hope your troubles are few. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I've been in love like you. You be brave, young lovers, and follow your star.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought-Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Call us toll-free anytime, 1-888-429-5471.
And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You fly down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet.
Farhan Dalla with us. He's the creator of the DVD Mind, Ball, and Soul. He's a spiritual personal trainer whose mission in life is to help those who see their value, those to see their value and their worthiness. He began his career as a physical therapist, working with world-famous athletes. He now offers people a way to succeed in their goals through intuitive readings, Reiki, heart resonance therapy, and psychotherapy. He's earned worldwide recognition as a former Reebok master trainer, international fitness presenter, and has spoken at some of the world's largest fitness conferences. And let us say, Farhan Wahi, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. When we talk about spirituality...
My pleasure.
Yeah, oh, and thank you. When we talk about spirituality... How does someone touch that? How does somebody know when they are touching their own essence, their own core, and at the same time keep it integrated with the body?
Right. Well, I think let's look at what the word spirit means. And for there, because sometimes when people hear the word spirituality, they kind of get a bit nervous about it and think there's some religious connotation to it. And first of all, let me explain that that's not the case. Everybody has a spirit. And if you compare it analogous to a car, if you look at us like a car, our physical body represents that aspect of the body of the car. The soul is not like the spirit. I like to call the soul as the steering wheel, which is guiding us. And the spirit is what I refer to as the fuel that moves us.
Okay, but let me ask you. Absolutely. And let me ask you this. Is some of the problems that we run into when we block the guide, when we mask ourselves, we hide ourselves, and we don't let that guide us to where we're supposed to be?
Right. So that's where I come in. And usually that's the case of what I call spiritual anorexia. And the spirit is that aspect of ourselves that makes us feel good. It's our positive thoughts, our actions, the environment that we surround ourselves in. It's all those things that make us feel good. And it's oftentimes that when we're suffering from negative thoughts, blocks in our lives that prevent us from feeling that spirit, which inevitably prevents us from receiving that information that you're referring to as guidance.
Okay, so let's say, for instance, in athletics, to really be your absolute mm-hmm. best, if you can unblock that whatever that is, that wall between your spirit and your physical body, so if you connect the two, you do mm-hmm. better. But if you move that same thing into business and in a relationship, isn't it all the same process? Just depends where you want to put it.
Absolutely. It can be applied to every aspect of your life, not just the physical. And that's one of the reasons why I find the term physical therapy so limiting. But like you described in my bio, I now apply those principles to help people in every aspect of their life, whether it's in their career, their relationship, or with themselves.
Okay, well, let's go to you personally. You struggled with weight a great portion of your life. And then you found your voice, your own guide, your own spirit. Where was that connection for you? And then how did the weight start to come off?
The first thing that I learned was my mirror was either my friend or my enemy. And so I started to make connections with the awareness of how I felt about myself every time I looked at myself in a mirror. And so I was given an exercise by a very wise person who said, the next time you look in a mirror, I want you to point at something only positive, okay? And so it started from there, and I started to make the connection that if I programmed myself by focusing on what feels good and the positive aspects of my physical being, then when I went into the gym and I started working out, I was now treating my body with a different perception, not because of what I didn't like, but because of what I liked, and also because of the way I was treating and respecting myself. And then what I noticed is that the results were a little more permanent, and not just that, but I wasn't depending also about the way that I looked in order to feel good about myself, but I was actually feeding myself those positive self-messages that were coming directly from me.
Now, by the way, when you talk about the positive self-messages, something called an affirmation in and of its own way is also a positive self-message. But for many, many people that I ran into in a long period of time, the affirmation or the positive self-message was nothing more than discovering what's underneath causing that to stop. And when we feed ourselves a positive message, and we're frightened to death of it because it may open us up to something, even if it's good, that we're not comfortable with, it's not known, we block it and we fight it. So realistically, isn't it a lot discovery? And if you could just grit your teeth, bite your tongue, and let it happen, the world can open up for you.
You know, and I tell people this, you don't necessarily have to believe the affirmation when you first start to work with it. And yes, there is a whole slew of things to uncover once you begin that process, because what you're saying is that I'm opening the crack and I'm allowing eventually for that door to open. But you often have to sit there and think about, you know, what resonates with you as well. And, you know, if you're having difficulty, for example, you know, and if you're 80 pounds overweight and you're looking in the mirror and it's hard to come up with that positive phrase, you can start with something that says you're in the process of getting to that goal. So, for example, you can look in the mirror and say, I'm in the process of making my body better, as opposed to, I love what I'm seeing. Do you see what I'm saying?
Sure.
So it makes it easier to take that affirmation and add the vibration of, yes, I believe what I'm saying to be true. And then in the process of the journey to come up with other ones as the physical changes are taking place.
Sure. And it becomes something that's manageable. That's something, it's a realistic goal. And I think that's where most people get blocked. Farhan, I think they take on a goal that is way beyond their ability to deal with whatever life is or their objectives are, and they end up failing. And inside is nothing more than validating to themselves that they couldn't do it in the first place. So, quote unquote, in one way, they win. But it's stepping beyond that and realizing that there are things that you can accomplish, but you can't get hit with it all at once.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, Michael, there's, you know, when I talked about spirit as being fuel, well, there's good fuel and then there's bad fuel. And you have a choice about what type of fuel you're going to feed yourself with. And consequence to some of the negative ones. For example, you know, do you know why Mondays are the busiest days in the gym? It's because of what people ate and drank over the weekend. Okay.
Yeah.
So the driving force or the fuel to get them there is guilt and anger. Okay. So
sure.
They may temporarily feel better about themselves because they're now at the gym as a consequence to their actions on the weekends. But their overall results, they're setting themselves up for complete failure. Plus, they haven't done anything to make themselves really feel good about themselves because they fed themselves with bad fuel. See what I'm saying?
Sure. No, absolutely. No question about it. And if you talk about guilt and anger, if you get down and you define it, anger is nothing more than blocked expression. Farhan, we've never been mad at anybody who's agreed with us. So you block it, you internalize it, and the problems start. Guilt is something that you don't think you should have done any way you look at it. You combine the two together, and you see most of the people walking up and down the streets. That's what they're made of.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's guilt and anger are probably two of the most negative vibrationally energetic forms of energy that's out there that are the most detrimental to us.
Sure, and
with
fear,
both emotional and physical consequences.
Sure, and fear is another one. Fear, I think, is a major one, and it's not so much fear of not accomplishing a goal. There's fear of accomplishing the goal. What is that old adage? Better unhappy than unsure. And people are frightened to death of the unknown, and the walk into the next room can be an absolute unknown. But if you're comfortable with yourself, you'll respond to whatever comes up, then things become unknown very quickly.
Absolutely. And my job as a spiritual personal trainer is to try to help people discover what that fear is, because sometimes people don't even know what their fears are.
No, absolutely not. By the way, when we talk the word, you know, you work with people intuitively. What does that mean? Define that so we know what we're working with.
Absolutely. I have a bag of tools that I'm trained in. And so I've trained with a variety of well-known, I want to say the word psychic and intuitives that are out there right now who have been amazing teachers in my life, who have allowed me to develop that other sense, that sixth sense, that sense that we all have.
Yeah.
And I use that as my guiding source when I'm working with my clients. So, you know, call it tapping into something, plugging into something other than, you know, my physical body, enabling to help unlayer what I'm seeing at the surface when people are talking to me to give them a better idea of what's happening at the deeper core.
So, in essence, you have to become who you're working with. You have to see the world through their
yes
eyes.
Yes and no. I mean, pardon me?
I said you have to see the world through their eyes before you can work with them to know what really is going on with them. That's what I mean.
Yeah, I'm kind of stepping into their soul, and I'm using my intuitive skills to direct me.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And again, it's when I say becoming them, when they walk out with them. But the point of contention is that you have to think like them. You have to experience the world like they do before you can actually tap in and say, let's look at this a little differently or whatever it is that you're dealing with at the time.
Right, absolutely. And it can be very intense work because when I'm doing this type of things, I'm getting to that place with that person where it probably hurts the most and is so raw and, you know, there's possibly so many layers of stuff covering it all up that it's almost like what I call doing psychic surgery, where we have to kind of cut through the layers and get to that place where it's most uncomfortable in order for us to get to what we need to do to resolve the issue and free the block or release the anger or uncover the grief, whatever it is.
Now, when you're dealing with people, now obviously you can't deal with everybody at one time, so the CD, the DVD, the DVD in and of itself, is that like working with you?
Yes, it's working with me on the physical and the mind and the spiritual aspect, absolutely. And the DVD is an integrative approach, yet a holistic approach to working out, where I've taken strength training combined with specific yoga postures as well as core training, using my knowledge as a physical therapist with the ball, and I brought it all together. I used my knowledge as a physical therapist to see how the core functions as an important stabilizer in the body, and strength training is so important. It's an important aspect of our training because of multiple reasons, as far as with the aging population alone, keeping our muscles and bones strong. And then what I saw in the industry, what was happening is that people who did yoga didn't necessarily did strength training and vice versa, because let's face it, you only have so many hours in a day. And you can't necessarily fit all of that into one workout. And I looked at all the different programs, and I put it together to really give you a complete holistic workout. Now, every time you do a move in my workout, when you're doing one exercise, you're using every single muscle in your body. Okay. Whereas if you were to go to the gym, you might work on your arm, you might work on your chest, you might work on your legs. But in every single move that you do in this workout, you're using every muscle in your body. And the benefit that is that it affects us in the way that we live in our everyday lives, because every action requires multiple muscles to work together, right?
Okay, yeah, but let me hold you up just for a second. Now, when you, on a practical right. level, so we can get an image of this,
yeah.
what does it look like to have to move all the muscles at the same time? What are we doing? Just one example.
Oh, absolutely. Okay, so if you imagine you're holding the ball in front of you, I mimic a functional activity where you pick something off the floor and then you put it up on the shelf. So right away, as you're squatting, you're using all the muscles in your legs. As you're holding the ball, you're using the muscles in your core to stabilize. And then with your arms, as you start to straighten up through the legs, you're placing the ball, imagining that you're placing it up on the shelf. But then what I do is I layer the movement to incorporate it as a three-dimensional pattern, because rarely are our movements in two-dimensional planes. We're always lifting and then slightly rotating. Perhaps we have to put that that book up on the shelf but slightly over to the left, and then perhaps you want to lift and move that book slightly over to the right. So I incorporate the three-dimensional aspects of movement into every movement pattern, and that's okay, just part of the warm-up.
So we're using our legs, we're using our glutes, we're using our abs, we're using our chest, we're using our shoulders through the entire thing.
You're using all your muscles, exactly.
Yeah. Okay, see, that makes sense.
Part of the workout is if you – sorry?
I'm saying most people don't do that. They're not even aware that that's really what you should be doing in a workout.
Well, I'll explain it to you like this. If you were to take every one of your muscles – and let's just pretend that they were in a member of a band. So your biceps were like the trumpet, and your quadriceps were the drums, and your calves were the guitar, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And you told all those members of the band to work out or play their instrument and practice separately.
For joining us, I think you're spot on with exactly what you're doing, and more people should get involved in it, because realistically, if you do what you're talking about doing, it can improve a personality, it can improve the way of life and the outlook on life also, which is critical. How you get up in the morning is how your day is going to be.
Exactly. So start your day off with a positive thought, and the best one I like is the one by Louise Hay, and my first thought every morning is, life loves me.
Yeah, gotcha. Loud and clear. Okay, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thanks for having me, Michael. I really appreciate it. That was a great, great, great chat.
Oh, my pleasure. Good night.
Good night.
There are so many fabulous faraway places to see. Why should Spain and Tahiti and Rio just be only names to you and me? I feel certain there's people we'd be glad to know there. So tell me, why don't we get up and just go there? Go to those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London, wonderful, fabulous.